Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, a weekly exploration of health and wellness topics affecting Vermonters. Brought to you in part by Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. Northfieldpharmacy.com. And Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee-owned and locally committed. Your participation is encouraged. Call with your questions, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Lewis Myers, and this is Healthcare Today. Before we begin, I want to add my congratulations to WDEV on their 90th birthday last week. I've been here since October, but I can tell this is truly feels like a family here at the station, and I think that comes through in all of its programming. And I thank you for listening and being part of that family. Today we have two very interesting guests. The first half hour, we're going to be talking with Dr. Mark Nevin and one of his associates, Ms. Victoria Frankel of the Northern New England Poison Center. They're going to tell us how to prevent and, if necessary, treat common household poisonings and accidents. In our second half hour, I'll be talking with Dan Batsy, who's director of Vermont's Emergency Preparedness and Injury Prevention Department. He's going to be telling us what they do at that department and also talking about some of the common things we need to be aware of in the summer, such as water safety, heat injuries, and insect bites. So, As always, we welcome your calls during the hour at 802-244-1777. And Dr. Nevin, welcome. Are you there with us?
Yes. Hi. Thank you for having us on the phone today.
Great. And I believe you have Ms. Frankel. I wondered if you would each introduce yourself briefly. I don't have your CVs, but if you could tell me each a little bit about your background.
Sure, I'll go first. My name is Mark Nevin. I'm a medical toxicologist and emergency medicine physician at Maine Medical Center, and I'm the medical director for the Northern New England Poison Center. I work clinically in the emergency department at Maine Medical Center, and I also provide consultation to other physicians throughout the region in Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont in the treatment of poisonings and drug overdoses.
And I don't know if it's Ms. or Dr. Frankel, if you're there.
Hi, yes. Thanks so much for having us. My name's Victoria Frankel. I am a registered nurse. I've been here at the Northern New England Poison Center for nearly 8 years now, and most of the time that I've spent here, I've been working on the hotline. And just this past year, I took on the role of public outreach and education.
And that's certainly a big part of why you're here, and we thank you. And I should say I do work in a hospital in Vermont, and I cannot tell you how invaluable it is when we have someone come into the emergency department who has ingested some substance, either a common substance or one that we've perhaps never even heard of, and we can pick up the phone and immediately talk to someone on your staff, and they've been always professional and helpful. So we really appreciate that. Tell me a little bit about the catchment of Northern New England. What's your catchment area?
Yeah, so we cover all of Northern New England, including Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont. And so what a lot of people don't realize is the Poison Center is more than a public health hotline. It's also an avenue for consultation between physicians. So if somebody has a sick patient in the hospital and they don't know how to treat the poisoning or drug overdose, they call us and we're able to provide that advice. We do a lot of home calls as well, where we try and help guide parents and other patients who are at home who may have taken an extra pill or possibly been exposed to a plant or mushroom, and we help provide guidance as to when it's safe to stay at home and when it's really important to seek emergency care.
Now, is your hotline 24/7?
It is, and I'd love to remind everybody who might be listening that The hotline is a national number. It's 1-800-222-1222. And anywhere in the country, you can call that phone number, and you'll be connected with your regional poison center. So if you happen to be calling from Vermont or anywhere else in northern New England, you will get connected with the friendly staff here at the Northern New England Poison Center.
Tell us a little bit about the training of the staff. I mean, this is very specialized staff that you have. What kind of training do people go through to become experts in this?
Yeah, so there's a few different avenues. I can speak directly to my experience. For medical toxicology, I did a residency in a primary specialty. It happens to be emergency medicine, but there's also internists and pediatricians who do this as well. And then I did a subspecialty training in medical toxicology, where I did research and education in treating poisonings and drug overdoses. So as a physician, I oversee the calls and advice provided by the great folks in the call center. So I'll let Victoria kind of speak to her experience and where she's coming from. But we do have both nurses and pharmacists who staff the phones here at the poison center. And so they have kind of a rich background, and that's really helpful when it comes to poisonings and drug overdoses. So I'll let Victoria speak to that.
Sure. Thanks so much. So like I said, I have been here for about 8 years now, but I'm fortunate enough to be working with some folks who have been here for over 30 years. So lots of on-the-job experience. At that time, the Poison Center was working in tandem with the 911 service for the hospital. And so most of the people on the hotline were people with EMS backgrounds. And since then, a lot of them are still with us and have actually gone through nursing school. At this point, we're about 50% pharmacists and nurses, which is great. It's really nice to have people working here from multiple backgrounds. And most of the, really all of the training that I've had, I've gotten here. There's nowhere else that you can learn how to work on a poison hotline outside of a poison center. So it's been all on-the-job experience. And after about 2 years' worth of experience and having so many calls under your belt, you sit for a national examination in order to become certified. And that's a requirement of poison centers across the country.
You mentioned that this is a national program, and they funnel the calls into the region. How is it funded nationally, the poison centers?
Poison centers throughout the country only have a small portion of their funding coming from the federal government. A lot of poison centers, depending on the state they operate in, have to be a bit financially nimble in order to fund the centers that they staff. So for the Northern New England Poison Center, we have a variety of different grant funding through the different states that we serve. And other states, based on their state legislature, have funding that helps support them in their clinical practice.
I guess
so
this
can be very variable throughout the country. Although it's a federal mandate that all states provide their constituents with poison center service, it is not federally funded.
Well, that gets into the whole area of unfunded federal mandates, and it certainly seems like as critical a service as you're providing, that the CDC or Department of Health and Human Services should, one would think, would want to fund this more on the federal level to make sure that, because some states simply may not have the money or inclination to fund these, and it then they're lacking a really critical service. Let's talk about some of the most common calls you get in regards to household poisonings. If you had to rank three or four of them, what would you say are the three or four most common calls?
Well, things that people tend to have in their home, over-the-counter medications, any personal care products or things that children tend to get into, and it, really anything goes. Little two-year-olds exploring their environment really could pick up anything and put it in their mouth. Even toys can sometimes cause a poisoning concern if it's something like a battery that's fallen out of a toy or something like that. I think the more common products are over-the-counter medications like Tylenol, ibuprofen. Maybe they're sitting out because the little kiddo was sick and they're requiring some doses of these medications or prescribed medications that people have in their homes. And then cleaners that everyone has around. I think those are probably some of the more common substances in terms of little kids getting into things, which really is a big part of what we deal with.
Let's talk about Tylenol. We know that Tylenol overdoses, whether intentional or accidental, can be very, very severely damaging to the liver. Can you talk a little bit about that, and how would we, if you had either a child or adult, and in the case of adult, it would probably be more intentional, one would imagine, but not always, but how would you treat a significant overdose of Tylenol?
Yeah, Tylenol is a particularly nasty drug when taken in overdose, and the problem with it is there really aren't any early signs of toxicity or poisoning. So somebody can take an excessive amount and they might not display symptoms of toxicity for a couple of days. And by the time they're experiencing symptoms such as abdominal pain and vomiting, the damage has already kind of taken effect. So we do see a lot of Tylenol cases. There's a great antidote for Tylenol if given within the first 8 hours. And then we tend to follow, depending on the extent of the overdose, we follow the Tylenol cases over a few days. In rare circumstances, in large overdoses, patients sometimes even require liver transplant. So it is a really serious overdose. And so that's why we really recommend for people that they keep their over-the-counter medications up and out of sight of children.
We also know when it comes to children, one of the cousins of Tylenol, I guess, although they're not related really, is aspirin. And we've certainly learned in the last several decades, two or three decades, that when children have viral infections or flu, that aspirin is not a good thing to give. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, there is a syndrome that's associated with aspirin use in children. And actually, a lot of aspirin cases that we see tend to be in the elderly because aspirin comes in an enteric formula to help with taking it and having less gastric effects. And so those aspirin tablets can form a concretion in the stomach. And so in the elderly who are taking a baby aspirin a day, we can start to see signs and symptoms of aspirin toxicity pretty quickly if they're not digesting it properly.
What would be the sign of aspirin toxicity?
Probably the first sign would be abdominal discomfort, but very quickly after that, tinnitus tends to happen. So that ringing in the ear is a symptom of what we call salicylism, which is aspirin toxicity. And so if there's ringing in the ear with excess aspirin use, that's a serious concern because aspirin toxicity can very quickly go bad. So after tinnitus develops, you can start seeing some increased respirations, breathing heavily, and that can quickly, seizures can quickly follow suit. So with aspirin in particular, we really recommend people coming into the hospital if there's a concern for overdose or.
Now you mentioned an antidote for Tylenol. Is there an antidote for aspirin poisoning?
There's a method that we use to try and clear the aspirin from the system, and basically we do something called urine alkalinization, which helps improve your kidney's clearance of the drug itself. But sometimes in severe overdoses, the only treatment is dialysis, where we're using a machine to remove the drug from the bloodstream. So it can be pretty serious, but we do have a really great way of treating it.
So we've talked about Tylenol and aspirin. What are some other most common substances that you see, at least in the household?
I think more and more commonly over the past 10 to 15 years, we've seen a lot of opioids. There's been a lot of press, of course, with the opioid epidemic. And really the gist of it is if there's more of a substance in a population, there's going to be a higher risk of accidental exposures in children just because it's in the environment that they're living in. And so even with medications that are used appropriately, sometimes kids can get a hold of them. And for opioids in particular, opioids will reduce the drive to breathe. And in children, that can be pretty severe and rapidly progressive. So for opioids, we really recommend that everyone come to the emergency department. There is a great treatment for opioid poisoning, which is naloxone or Narcan, but oftentimes we need to admit children to the hospital for these longer-acting opioid overdoses.
With the more widespread now legalization of cannabis, there has been some concern about children getting their hands on that as well. Now, in Vermont, I think the gummies or edibles are still illegal. Some states are legalizing those. I would suspect that someday they'll be more widely legal. Tell us about what happens if children somehow get into the cannabis stash.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked us that because this is becoming a real concern for us here at the Poison Center. I think the general idea that cannabis is not poisonous is probably a false narrative, and we see plenty of children who have to be admitted to pediatric ICUs for cannabis. Now, I will admit that there has not been a reported death from cannabis overdose, even in children, but we have seen many children come pretty close and require oxygen and other supportive treatments in an ICU setting to get them through the overdose. The problem is a lot of these cannabis edibles look very appealing to a small child. So if there's a brownie or a cookie or a candy substance that has THC in it, there's no question that a child is going to go right for that and eat it. And the dose can be pretty excessive for a small child. Some of these edible products have upwards of 400 milligrams of THC, the active cannabinoid in the plant. And that's quite a lot for a small 2-year-old or 3-year-old to be exposed to.
Some of these also look very appealing to pets. And I know that neither of you are veterinarians, but what happens when dogs or cats or other household pets, do you ever get calls about the pets eating things that they
should? We do. There is a couple of different, services for veterinary poisoning, but we do take calls from people regarding their pets as well. And sometimes they can develop seizures. And in fact, we've even seen seizures in humans after large cannabis ingestions, even in adults, actually. But the first symptoms might be just a stumbling gait or the dog just is kind of isolated or acting funny. But the more serious concerns would be seizures in the animal.
So, Ms. Frankel, tell me about perhaps – before I go back to you, let me ask either of you. We're talking about Tylenol and aspirin, some of the other prescribed or non-prescribed medications. In recent decades, the bottles have gotten very difficult to open, and that's purposeful. We don't want children to be able to open them easily. Sometimes they're actually rather difficult even for adults to open. But has that made a big difference, having the sort of child preventative capsules, containers rather?
Yeah, I think it has made a big difference. One important distinction to make, however, a lot of folks assume that these bottles that are really hard for us to open, they assume that they're completely child-proof, which isn't true. It's really just meant to slow them down, and especially kids that are watching, you know, everything in their environment, they unfortunately do learn how to open these bottles. So I would just caution folks to not assume that they're totally child-proof. They're just resistant.
Well, we've talked a lot, and not yet on this show, although perhaps in a future show, we've talked a lot about gun safety and about keeping weapons in the house away from children. I would think that having the same mentality about prescribed medications might be helpful.
Yes, I agree with that wholeheartedly. Keeping medications, even if they're over-the-counter, because we know even over-the-counter medications can be dangerous, like aspirin and Tylenol, and then also considering that cannabis should be thought of as a medication as well, and that should also be kept up and out of sight of children. Even if it's in an edible form, it should just be out of sight from the kids.
So, Ms. Frankel, I interrupted myself a moment ago. Let me, in the few minutes we have left, maybe tell us about two or three either more common or perhaps even unusual calls that you can remember that you fielded and hopefully helped people.
Sure. So we're right in the middle of a New England summer, and summer is our busier time of year for call volume. I think that's a New England thing. But maybe not a household product, but perhaps right outside your front door, there's probably some mushrooms growing. We talked a little bit about pests. Pests are definitely very likely to get into lawn mushrooms, especially if you have a Labrador. But we get a lot of calls about small children taking bites out of mushrooms this time of year. And unfortunately, we do have poisonous mushrooms in northern New England. I'd recently spoken with someone who was from out of state and didn't necessarily realize that these mushrooms just pop up on your lawn overnight. So I would encourage everybody to be checking their lawn if you have small kiddos or even pets, especially after it rains. Just get rid of those mushrooms. A lot of times, you know, a small ingestion isn't a big concern, but like I said, sometimes these are actually quite poisonous and would warrant monitoring of labs and possibly even visiting the emergency room. Other common things this time of year, going along with mushrooms, berries is a pretty common thing. Folks call us about kids getting into. Again, we do have poisonous berries here, usually not a big concern if it's just one or two. But I would encourage folks to call us so that we can help them figure out the next best step.
So if someone calls you about a berry, I guess you ask them to describe it, and you must have a picture book, as we do like the PDR with medications.
Unfortunately, it's a little too complicated for us to help identify plants over the phone. We do have a mycologist that we work with to help identify mushrooms when the need arises. For berries, we actually rely on folks to bring a piece of the plant to a local greenhouse, and hoping somebody there who is familiar with what grows locally can give us an idea of what it is. If the situation turns out that a child does develop symptoms, then it, you know, would warrant them going into the hospital just to be observed at least.
You know, just listening to your voice on the phone, you sound like someone it would be very comforting to talk to. I would imagine the people on your hotline have some training simply on not counseling, but just it's almost like a suicide hotline in a way. I mean, you're going to have people who are very upset and distraught calling you.
I think we're all pretty practiced in calming folks if they're upset about a situation, for sure. I mean, there's cases where we do have to say, you know, this is an emergency. You need to hang up and call 911. But I think that folks do appreciate at least us basically giving them permission to call 911 because they're not always sure if that's the appropriate thing to do. But that is a big part of what we do. And some folks, it's just a matter of wanting to get peace of mind if they're not overly concerned but just want to, you know, get some more information. We're happy to help out with those kinds of questions too.
And one of the real benefits of being able to call us is that sometimes we can save you a trip to the emergency department, particularly in these strange times. If you can avoid going to the emergency department, that's even better. And we can help make that determination with you if you call us.
Well, I want to thank both of you. I hope our listeners have been listening. I hope all of those Labrador Retrievers out there have been listening. This is a really important service. Can you once again give that, very briefly, give that 800 number?
Yes, it's 1-800-222-1222.
All right, so everybody keep that on your refrigerator. Let's stay safe. Thank you both for being with us. We'll be back after the break.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Myers here. Welcome back to the second half. We have with us Mr. Dan Batsy. Mr. Batsy is the current Director of Emergency Preparedness and Injury Prevention in Vermont. He was and has been a paramedic for 31 years in New York, Maine, and of course, Vermont. Mr. Batsy, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, you have a very long history of taking care of people out in the community. Tell us about your transition into being an administrator and head of a department.
Yeah. Thank you very much. So I was a street paramedic, as you mentioned, for almost 20 years, and then I started doing a little teaching. I ran a paramedic program in Maine for about 10 years or so, and just sort of transitioned. You know, being a street paramedic is a young person's game, unfortunately, and those who stick around a long time do take that transition most of the time to the other side of the desk. But I still, you know, it's only been about 3 years since I've been fully off the road. I've stuck it out for as long as I could, and just a little bit of a different challenge now.
What are some of the things you learned in all those years out on the street working that have helped you sort of oversee or think about sort of globally emergency preparedness and injury prevention?
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful question. You know, I think the biggest and most important thing that really great paramedics have is the ability just to kind of stay calm. I used to look at folks that I admired when I was a new a rookie paramedic, and they'd come on that scene and everything would be going crazy, and it would be the, you know, biggest, craziest mess that we could possibly be in, and they just bring it down and calm everything down and calm the people around them down, and just kind of being able to keep your head when everything is really difficult. That was, I think, the most important thing that I learned, and that's been a really important part of leadership for me really ever since I began to be a leader at any level.
That is a very interesting perspective. Tell us about the Department of Emergency Preparedness and Injury Prevention. What is the scope of that? What is your mandate?
Yeah, so I work for the Department of Health, and within the Department of Health, my division is actually called the Division of Emergency Preparedness, Response, and Injury Prevention. So we oversee hospital preparedness and the sort of medical preparedness side of the house. Remember, we have Vermont Emergency Management that does the larger state emergency plan and things like that. But we work with our hospital partners and our community stakeholders to make sure they're ready for the very kind of thing that we've been dealing with for the last 17 months and a myriad other kinds of emergencies out there. But my division also oversees emergency medical services for the state of Vermont. So we license and manage all the fire departments and ambulances that provide ambulance care in Vermont. And then we also have an injury prevention side of the house that does several projects from naloxone distribution to passenger safety, working with agency of transportation to suicide prevention and literally dozens of other initiatives to try to keep people safe.
Well, that's a huge mandate. I actually had no idea that it was quite that broad. Let me. You mentioned the emergency medical services. We have had a show on that, but let me ask you this, because what I'm hearing in the community is for example, down the Rutland area. I mean, they're having trouble staffing some of the local emergency medical departments. Is that a problem throughout Vermont, or is it a patchy problem?
No, it's a problem throughout Vermont. It's a problem throughout the United States. It's a very real challenge facing emergency medical services, no matter where you are. And there's a lot to it. It's a really complicated problem that goes all the way from the way that ambulance services are reimbursed for their services. It goes to the historical nature of volunteer versus professional, and, you know, lots and lots of other complexities that really make it a most difficult nut to crack. We've certainly seen it all across Vermont, our groups, and again, from the smallest volunteer agency to the largest paid service, we struggle. We struggle for lots of reasons. And Vermont has its own unique challenges. Cost of living and the demographics of our population all make it challenging. But we're taking a lot of initiatives. We're really trying hard to look at it, everything from doing some leadership training and really taking a hard look at some data-driven numbers around why people are leaving and what are the, you know, we worked with the University of Vermont's Public Health Department to look at what are the causes, what are the reasons why people are leaving emergency medical services, and how can we specifically target those issues. We've worked with the Vermont legislature to get some money for training. They were very good to us during the COVID crisis and really funded a whole lot of emergency training, and that really saved us from a big deficit from when all of our classes were shut down for a long time.
If someone listening to the show wanted to step up and become an EMT or perhaps eventually a paramedic, who is there a statewide place they contact, or do they have to go locally?
Sure. Well, they can do both, right? They can reach out to the local service, and their local service is more than likely willing to help them along that path. If they want more information, they can certainly go to our website. So healthvermont.gov is the Department of Health's website, and we have emergency medical services within that. So if you search right in the healthvermont.gov, you can find our website. We maintain a running list of classes, so original training. We also will link up opportunities there. So if people are looking for help, we'll try to specifically guide them for that as well.
Well, if anyone's listening, as a former EMT myself, I can tell you it is not only a great service to the community, but it opens a lot of doors and a lot of avenues for a lot of different fields in the healthcare system. So it's a terrific thing to do for a number of reasons. Let me ask you, so you
Lewis,
mentioned...
Go
ahead.
And remember that there's a place for everybody out there in our emergency medical services. You don't have to be a professional firefighter. You don't necessarily have to work 12 hours a day. There are so many volunteer agencies and so many different types of services out there that there's a match for any commitment that you're able to offer us. So it's a big tent welcoming everybody.
Well, this is a state where I think people do step up.
They sure do.
Let me ask you about a few things. Water safety. We're in the middle of summer, of course, and that, of course, water safety, I'm sure, extends year-round, but what about summertime? What do you teach people or try and teach people about water safety?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, it's before we start talking about risks and dangers and stuff, I want to say that I'm really happy that people are able to get out of their house. I mean, we had such a year of being cooped up and quarantined and all that it's really great that we're able to get outside again and start doing some of the recreational activities that make us who we are. And, you know, we certainly live at a place where there's a lot of water activities throughout the state, and we want to make sure that we do it safely. Across the United States, there's a lot of people, though, that die from drowning, about 4,000 a year on an average in the United States. And, you know, with that 4,000 who die, there's about another 200 per fatality that have to be rescued from the water. So that's a really big number. The other thing is it may very well be a relatively low reported number. The reporting may be skewed, because up until about 10 years ago, there wasn't a formal definition of what drowning meant for our numbers to know out there. So what we know is it's a big problem, and there's a lot of people out there who are getting themselves into dangerous situations, and unfortunately, too many of them are ending up with a really bad outcome. So we want to make sure that people are safe. If you look at the way that people die related to drowning-related problems, to submersion injuries. The big group that we really worry about and the one that makes up the largest percentage is the small children, 1 to 5 year olds. So when you think about how to deal with that problem, it's mostly prevention. It's about putting fences around pools. It's about teaching swimming lessons. It's about responsible supervision as well. And, we all want to be able to go to the beach and we all want to have our kids there. And certainly that's fun. But remember that it's just a minute in time is enough to put that child in a really bad situation, even if there's a lifeguard. So if you can't supervise those kids, put a life jacket on and use some kind of a flotation device so that you don't have to worry about a bad situation. So that's the big one. If you look at the distribution of deaths, the other group that we have to worry about are the adolescents. So it's a bimodal distribution. There's two big groups that we think about, and the other one is a group of like teenagers. So 15 to 25 year olds that we worry about, and for the most part, drownings in that age group are about irresponsible behavior. If you look at the manner in which those accidents happen, it's almost always associated with alcohol or drugs or both. And it's almost always associated with risky behavior. So overestimating swimming ability, leaping from heights, things like that really populate that group. So we want to make sure that we're talking about this with our teenagers and our adolescents. We want to make sure that we're having these discussions to make sure that they're not going to lump themselves into the group of dangerous activities that leads them down this path.
Unfortunately, alcohol related injuries aren't confined to adolescents either. Adults out on their boats might be drinking a bit.
Yeah, and nor are drownings, right? I mean, there's certainly a lot of adults that drown, older Americans that drown as well. And certainly that is another situation that we should be conscious of as well. When we think about the way that we can deal with this problem, the other things that we think about is there was a physician, and his name was Spillman. He talked about the drowning chain of survival. And, that like the American Heart Association's chain of survival around cardiac arrest, he talked about a five-stage process of prevention and recognizing when somebody's in trouble. So, again, that's that supervision piece we want to lay eyes on our not only our children but our friends and colleagues. Remember that if you are recognizing that somebody's drowning, it's really important that you don't just jump in the water. And I know that may be hard to do when it's your child, and there's certainly circumstances where that may be necessary. But if we can provide flotation first, that will keep you from being killed in this process of trying to make the rescue. And we certainly know from some research, especially in Australia and New Zealand, that a fair number of people are injured every year trying to save that person who's drowning. So we want to respect the notion that it takes a certain level of skill to save a person who's struggling in the water. So flotation devices, rescue rings and poles and things like that are always the first choice.
Something along the lines of put your own face mask on it in an airplane and then put your child's on. You're able
exactly
to help
right.
that person. Can we talk a little bit about heat? We're also, as whether global warming, of course, but we are seeing hotter summers in Vermont. And people may be more aware of that in the South than they are in the North. What do you recommend to people how to beat the heat?
Yeah, heat is heat. A lot of the same lessons that we talk about with submersion injuries and drownings are the same here, right? It's about supervision and it's about helping one another out and paying attention. There are certainly people who are vulnerable to high temperatures and high humidity, especially our older relatives and friends, especially people with low degrees of mobility or people who have limited capability for air conditioning and live in hot environments. So we want to make sure first and foremost that we're paying attention to people when we have high temperatures and high humidity, because that's the real challenge, right? We know that once the temperature rises above a certain degree, once it gets above your core temperature, the typical things that we do to reduce the heat are really ineffective. So if your house is 110 degrees, there's very little opportunity for your body to dump that heat off. The same thing when humidity gets very high. When humidity gets above 75%, and although that's not super common here in Vermont, and we've seen in this summer alone a couple of days where it's been that high, our sweating capability, the evaporation that helps us get rid of heat, is defeated under those circumstances. So, you know, we want to pay attention to those who are most vulnerable around us and offer them whatever resources we can, you know, get them to a place that has some cooling, take a trip to the mall, you know, help out with the installation of air conditioning, things like that. Those are all
What are really the warning signs of what are warning signs that someone may be getting in trouble in terms of heat stroke or heat exhaustion?
So this is really important because it's changed, right? When I remember when I was coming up and was a scout, or when I took my first EMT class, we talked a lot about recognizing and differentiating the different kinds of heat stroke. We talked about heat exhaustion and heat stroke, and we said that a person in heat exhaustion would be sweaty and they'd be red-faced, and a person with heat stroke would be dry. But what we've really understood, and when we started doing some research around this, is it's just not that clear. And there's so many different variations depending upon things like exertion. You know, so the football player who's out there exerting themselves at sort of top physical capacity, that's a really dangerous circumstance when their body temperature starts going up. And the transition that we've sort of taught for many, many years of they get sweaty and then they get dry, it just doesn't work that way. If there's one piece that I would suggest from an old paramedic is look at their mental status. If you're talking about a person who's in a heat challenge, that is, they're overheated or, you know, been exposed to a hot environment and they're just not acting right, that's a really dangerous situation. And the longer they stay at a hot level, the more injured they can become. So if they're confused or not engaging properly, that's the person that needs to get cooled off right away and immediately.
Let's insects, which are, again, with global warmer climate change, we're going to probably see different kinds of insects and perhaps extended periods when they're actively doing what they do. Here in Vermont, what are some of the – well, we know about Lyme, and we've talked about that and some of the tick-borne illnesses on a previous show, but what about some of the other insects, stings, bites?
Yeah.
What are those?
So, you know, I'm not a toxicologist, and I don't – you know, my background and training is really as sort of an emergency provider. So I think about things that are emergent, the things that kill you and things that, you know – put you at life-threatening risk. And the good news about Vermont is we have very few of those things. I mean, yeah, there's some rattlesnakes that we may have to worry about, but, you know, they're so rare that I don't think that anybody in Vermont is going to get into that circumstance unless they really, really, really tried hard to do that. And, you know, as global warming, as you mentioned, changed and climate's changed, we do start thinking about, you know, the recluse spiders and black widow spiders that were traditionally kept in the South and the Southwest and the Western states, there's at least some measure of possibility that we could see that change. But, you know, when I think about that, when you actually look at the numbers around some of those biting animals in the U.S., the fatalities are so few and the morbidity, the injury associated with those are so few that it's really nothing that we should get too worried about. I pulled some numbers and it actually – there's never been a fatality in the U.S. that's 100% verified associated with a brown recluse spider, even though we talk about a lot of potential and danger and stuff like that. And the black widow spiders that we worry about with the neurotoxic venom, their numbers are exceptionally low, too.
What about bee stings, though? Let's talk about something more common. If someone gets stung by either one bee and they're very allergic or many bees and they're not allergic, can that can be a problem?
So that's where my wheelhouse comes in, right? Because it's the allergy that we really should be worried about in anaphylaxis. Now, remember that the worry is also still pretty relative, right? And although we pay a lot of attention to allergy and anaphylaxis these days, and there's certainly hospital admissions for allergy and anaphylaxis have gone up in the last decade, the numbers of fatalities really haven't. And in all of the research that we talk about with allergy and anaphylaxis, the numbers are really, really low. It's 0.21 to 0.7 per million. That is 0.21 fatalities per million people, which means that in the U.S. over the last 5 years, there's only been about 100 people a year countrywide that have died from anaphylaxis from any cause, from medications or bee stings or food allergies. So these are really, really rare situations. But the reality is they can hurt us, so we want to be aware of it. So a couple things. One, of course, not everybody that's allergic knows they're allergic, and there are situations where an allergy can surprise us, especially when it comes to medications and things like that. But the good news is that most people who have a severe allergic reaction know they're allergic. So, you know, that's people managing their own problem, and they typically will have EpiPens. And, you know, typically the easiest way we identify these is that there's some sort of an exposure in a person that is allergic. But there are some warning signs that we should be aware of, and that's especially around the physical findings that we see. So if a person has an exposure that makes us think about an allergy, anytime they're having trouble breathing, that's a really dangerous finding, and we want to make sure that we're seeking immediate help right away. The other finding that gets us really concerned is anybody that has a low blood pressure. And you might say, Dan, we don't carry blood pressure cuffs. But again, these are the people that will have difficulty standing up. You know, they pass out if they try to stand up, or they have altered mental status, same as we were talking about before. Those are another set of dangerous findings as well. And then the third is sort of the rapid onset of symptoms. And there's three findings that we get that raise our eyebrows in the back of ambulances. One is a systemic-wide rash. So a rash that isn't isolated to one specific part of the body, but like crosses the midline of the body that gets to both sides of the body. And that could be like hives, urticaria. It can also be itchiness and itchy skin. And if that's happening all across their body, that's something that's really raising a red flag for us. Same thing with swelling. If they get swollen up all over, that's another issue, especially if it's in their mouth or their tongue or difficulty speaking. That's a pretty big red flag. And then the other one that hardly anybody ever talks about is gastrointestinal distress, and in particular, like cramping and diarrhea. A person having a severe allergic reaction oftentimes will have that response from their GI tract, and that can be a warning sign as well. Of course, it's a big picture, right? It's not one finding, but sort of the progression of the findings and the totality of the findings. But any one of those should be a pause to seek help right away.
Well, we have been talking as we near the end here. We've been talking. I don't want to make it sound too grim, because we do want people to get outdoors this summer. And as Mr. Batsy said, people have been isolated for a long period of time, and it's for your health. It's important to get out, be active. Both our guests, all of our guests today, have been talking really about prevention and about keeping us healthy. And there's so much more to learn and so much to be aware of. I just want to reemphasize what Mr. Batsy said earlier, that we need people to step forward and hopefully become EMTs. It's a great way to serve your community. Thank you, Mr. Dan Batsy, our head of emergency preparedness. We want you to join us next week. My guest will be Dr. Ernest Bove, who's a longtime urologist in the Rutland area. He'll be talking about urology, which includes kidney stones, prostate cancer, and other problems. Until then, be kind to yourselves, be kind to others.
Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, brought to you in part by AgeWell Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee-owned and locally committed. Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. NorthfieldPharmacy.com.
The music for this program was written and produced by Armin Bayajian.